On this week in Enterprise Tech, you ever wonder what could happen if internet service became a utility? Well, we'll discuss it. What about that app you can't stop using, but you find out it might have been abandoned by its developer? What do you think? Security risk? Well, Curtis takes us through that. Plus, we have a great guest, Joe Garber, Global Head Strategy and Solutions for Micro Focus. He takes us through digital transformations and what organizations can do to stay ahead of that curve. Shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 395, recorded May 29th, 2020. Digital transformation for an analog world. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by ExtraHop. ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Get tips on securing and supporting remote access or check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/enterprise. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, great to see you back, man. What's going on this week for you?
I've been working on fixing surveillance cameras and emergency call boxes to make the campus a safer place for my nieces.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, how many cameras are you up to now?
I've actually lost count. There are a lot of cameras, and part of the issue is trying to integrate it all and set up rules and, you know, motion detect and all that stuff, and make sure that, you know, when things happen, it pops up for the 24/7 monitoring consoles.
All right. Makes sense. Well, thanks for being here. Well, speaking of experts, we have our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, I don't think the vulnerabilities and hackers were sleeping this week, were they?
No, they've been using the pandemic to effectively work from home or self-isolation or wherever they're working from. They're still out there doing their thing. The black hats, the white hats, the gray hats, lots going on in cybersecurity. And, well, I'm glad because it keeps me employed for another week.
That it does. Well, speaking of enterprise news, we've definitely had a busy week and a lot of security news as well. So let's get to it. Now, ever wonder what could happen if internet service could become a utility? Well, what's the worst could happen there? Well, we'll get into that. Do you ever wonder if an app that you use a ton hasn't been updated in a while, maybe abandoned? What happens to those apps? What happens to you? Maybe vulnerabilities there? We'll talk about that. Organizations are always looking for ways to digitally transform, making that easier for them. Well, we have Joe Garber, Global Head Strategy and Solutions for Micro Focus, and he's here to take us through that and how maybe organizations can make it easier to digitally transform. But before we get into all that, we have to get into this week's blips. Now, it wouldn't be an enterprise week without a leak. And this week, we have hackers targeting a university with ransomware. Now, this past week, Michigan State University received a deadline to pay ransomware attackers under the threat that the files would be stolen from their institution's network and will be leaked to the public. Now, a countdown timer on the attacker's website shows that the university has about 6 days to comply or secret data, quote unquote, will become public. Now, the site set up by NetWalker ransomware gang gives no details about the attack, but they posted images with directories, a passport scan, and two financial documents allegedly stolen from the university's network. Now, NetWalker ransomware relies on multiple programs for remote access, like TeamViewer, AnyDesk, files from public code repositories and custom PowerShell scripts. However, they also use at least three legitimate tools to uninstall security software on a compromised system. Now, researchers at Sophos Security Software and Hardware Company shared in a report yesterday that the threat actor also used legitimate removal tools from ESET Antivirus, Trend Micro Security Agent, and Microsoft's Security Client that is part of the Microsoft Security Essentials package. Now, they also found individual samples of the Zeppelin Windows ransomware and the Smog Linux ransomware as well. Now, one of them is the CVE-2020-0796, for which there is a proof of concept exploit code released for a local privilege escalation. Now, it can be also exploited for remote code execution, but the code for this is not currently available to the public. Now, NetWalker ransomware group advertised recently that they were looking for new collaboration with access to large enterprise networks. Now, the move is meant to distance themselves from malware distribution through spam, which is their common method. Now, as an incentive, the group promised affiliates huge rewards, like actually a cut between 80 to 84% of a payout. Now, our other ransomware operators typically offer only about 70% for the ransom money. Now, as we've talked about before, these ransomware networks are growing and more contract for hire models are being followed, making it harder to track the real groups that are doing the attacks. As always, this just reminds us our organization should stay up to date on the latest patches and make sure we keep backups as critical systems.
Well, a GitHub supply chain attack is using the Octopus scanner malware. Back on March 9th, the GitHub Security Incident Response Team, or CERT, received a message from security researcher JJ, who had discovered a set of GitHub repositories actively serving malware. A deep dive analysis of the malware revealed it was built to compromise NetBeans projects, something that they hadn't seen before on GitHub. All affected projects were actively serving backdoored code, and the owners of these repositories were completely unaware. Once the GitHub security team learned the command and control server wasn't active, they were able to reduce the risk level and take a closer look at Octopus Scanner, which is an open source supply chain malware. The unique feature around this malware is that it's targeting developers as a means of spreading, the security team explained. Once the computer gets infected, it looks for NetBean files to infect. When Octopus Scanner lands on a machine, it looks for signs indicating the NetBeans IDE is in use on a developer system. And if it is, Octopus Scanner ensures that every time a project is built, any resulting jar files are infected with a dropper. When executed, the payload ensures persistence and spreads a remote access Trojan, or RAT. For developers, the challenge is knowing their dependencies, knowing when they need to be patched. For open source maintainers, challenges in preventing issues and responding as quickly as possible whenever it's necessary.
Well, SpaceX and the U.S. Army signed a deal to test Starlink broadband for military use. The U.S. Army has signed a three-year deal with SpaceX to test the company's Starlink satellite broadband service, according to Space News Today. On May 20th, the Army and SpaceX signed a cooperative research and development agreement called CRADA. An Army source told the organization, this will allow the Army to use Starlink broadband in order to determine whether it should be rolled out for wider use. CRADAs are commonly used by the military to evaluate technologies and services from the private sector before it commits to buying them, according to Space News. The Army, in this case, wants to be able to assess the performance of the Starlink low Earth orbit internet service when connected to military systems. The Army will seek answers to key questions such as what ground equipment it will need to use Starlink and how much systems integration work could be required. Keep in mind, a CRADA was used also for Iridium and before that in Marsat. So this is not a new project. So anyway, this is yet another step in the never-ending search to increase communications in the battlefield. One of my original research projects was with DARPA, and it was called SenseIt, that sought to provide self-healing, self-organizing mesh networks to extend sensors into the battlefield. This next step would bring unparalleled levels of information for the warfighter, but also unparalleled attack surfaces.
Now, we all depend on email for our daily communication. I do, especially. Sometimes you have to use it on the go, and it's convenient to use the clients that are integrated with the mobile device that you use. They should be more secure, shouldn't they? Well, when those clients have security flaws, it could be devastating. Unfortunately, iOS Mail is in the news again. A cybersecurity agency in Germany has issued a warning urging all iOS users to install Apple's latest security updates, which patch two zero-click security vulnerabilities that impact the company's default email app. Now, the interesting thing in these flaws was they were found years back in the US and were being actively exploited in attacks targeting iOS users since at least January of 2018. Now, Apple has acknowledged the security flaws, though the company says it has found, quote, no evidence they were used against customers. Apple has released security updates with iOS 12, iOS 13.5, and iOS 13.5 beyond that, that fix the vulnerabilities for all affected iOS versions. Now, due to the criticality of the vulnerabilities, the BSI recommends that the respective security update be installed on all affected systems immediately. Now, both of the security flaws affecting Apple's Mail app are no-click vulnerabilities, which result from a memory consumption issue, and they can be triggered after the app processes a malicious crafted message. Now, the first vulnerability, tracked as CVE-2020-9819, could lead to heap corruption, while the second one, tracked as 9818, may lead to unexpected memory modification or application termination. Fortunately, Apple has addressed flaws for the release of both iOS 13.5 for iPad, iOS 13.5 as well, which offer improved memory handling and bounds checking. Now, the vulnerabilities affected for iOS 6S, iPhone 6S, and later iPad Air 2, and later iPad Mini 4, and later, and the iPad Touch 7th generation, according to the iOS security release notes. While high-profile targets are the most at risk here, it's still highly recommended that all iOS users install Apple's latest security updates to avoid falling victim to any potential attacks that exploit the two vulnerabilities.
Researchers have ID'd a hacktivist who defaced nearly 5,000 websites. A politically motivated hacktivist who since 2013 defaced nearly 5,000 websites in 40-plus countries has been tripped up by a series of operational security mistakes he made during his 7-year hacking spree. Security researchers at Checkpoint Software, who were commissioned by a foreign government to hunt down the hacker, this week identified him as a 20-something individual living in the municipality of Uberlândia in Brazil. The hacker, who used the handle Vandal the God, defaced websites belonging to governments in Brazil, Argentina, Thailand, Vietnam, and dozens of other countries. Over the last year, though, a majority of his targets, 57%, were U.S.-based and included websites belonging to cities, states, and healthcare organizations. According to Checkpoint, its investigation showed that while anti-government sentiment was a major driving factor, the hacker was also motivated by other reasons. One of them, try and achieve a personal goal he had set for himself of defacing 5,000 websites worldwide. Data from a service that maintains a record of web defacement incidents shows that Vanda the God failed at this, having only defaced some 4,820 sites since 2013. Vanda the God's extensive tweets and his social media activity are what ultimately led to his exposure. The researchers were able to dig up other information from the hacker's public posts on Twitter and Facebook, including photos of his living room from different angles, that allowed them to establish a firm connection between the individual named MR in Brazil and Vanda the God on the web.
All right. While I'm talking about this article, think back. How long has it been since your doctor swabbed the back of your throat with a swab to take a sample to send to the lab? Now, while you're thinking about this, here's the article. A fidget spinner to detect urinary tract infections. Urinary tract infections have been called the canary in the coal mine of global antibiotic resistance, with more than half of all women having a UTI in their lifetime, and men also increasing in susceptibility as they age. UTIs are one of the most common bacterial infections in the world. Because it's not always possible to check for a bacterial infection in a urine sample, patients are often given antibiotics on the basis of symptoms alone, a practice that contributes to the growing resistance of many UTIs to most common treatments. We may be rescued by an unexpected hero, the fidget spinner. In a paper in Nature Biomedical Engineering this week, researchers in South Korea and India describe a new test for UTIs that needs nothing more than a couple of spins by hand of a spinner-like device. Its results, which can be read by anyone, are ready in about an hour. Okay, so not so enterprise IT, but reducing antibiotic-resistant drugs is big business, and you just need to be married to know about UTIs and how much work can be lost to them. Then combine with the ability to help diagnose people in the field, and you have a huge winner, especially for my friends with a double X chromosome.
Now, Tim Brookins is a longtime engineer who has always looked for ways to help the community. Now, when the COVID-19 crisis hit, he jumped into gear and used his engineering prowess to help others by developing a product called CARE-19. Now, CARE-19 got national recognition recently because it helps users record where they've been over the last 14 days in case they test positive for COVID-19. Now, remembering where you've been in is actually important to the contact tracing process, as it enables the tracer to reach out to people who you've made encountered with while infected. Well, this past month, Tim got a lesson in crisis management and the media. He was woken up at 3 a.m. to an email telling him that there would be damaging report of his app that day. He had 13 hours to track down the issue and see if it really was an issue or not. Now, imagine if he wasn't actually awake at 3 a.m. there. Now, as a security researcher, as he researched this more, he found that the security firm that reported the issue actually contacted media before they contacted him. If nothing else, this looked like the privacy and security firm, which will be left unnamed, was looking for more fame than it was to help the vulnerable application developer. Now, what was the flaw that they claimed? Well, the major claim or implication was that they were giving users personal location data to Foursquare for their use. Now, as it turned out, that was unequivocally false. Now, what the app developer did do was it added a couple changes for their code to the app and have it revise this privacy policy to be more transparent. Now, what this has proven is that there are real people behind some of these solutions and applications, and they are trying to do some good. I guess the message we have to security and privacy firms out there, do the right thing, help app developers make the right choices, and actually treat them like people. All the rest will fall into place. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is ExtraHop. Now, the new IT reality is remote access on a massive scale. There's rapid cloud and multi-cloud adoption and a steady increase in Internet of Things devices, all on top of the rise of cybercrime. Now, it's more important than ever that organizations can see everything that's going on in their environment, from the cloud to data center to customer. But in order to protect and scale your business, you need more than unified visibility. You also need context for detections and intelligence response workflows, so teams can collaborate easily and act fast. ExtraHop helps you detect threats and performance issues up to 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently. Now, ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Now, Wizard of the Coast secures and supports their AWS cloud with ExtraHop. Now, Chief Architect and Information Security Officer Dan McDaniel said, "There's no other company that aligns to supporting the DevOps model, the speed, and the lack of friction than ExtraHop." Ulta Beauty uses ExtraHop to secure their Google Cloud as well, to keep network and security teams closely aligned so engineers have more time to focus on innovation. Now, senior IT engineer John Kreese says, "Before ExtraHop, we were limited visibility into what's going on in the cloud, but now we can quickly identify vulnerabilities and exploits and understand how our applications are performing in the cloud. Take control of your cloud security with ExtraHop. Get tips on securing and supporting remote access or check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/enterprise. That's ExtraHop. extrahop.com/enterprise. And we thank ExtraHop for their support of this week, Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, it's 2020. We all know that. And the coronavirus pandemic has underscored how crucial broadband service is in our American lives for work, entertainment, and school. I can definitely tell you I rely on it every day, all day long. And it's just a necessity. And yet it's regulated just yet as a utility, the way services like water and electricity are. Now, back in 2014 and 2015, there was a really hot debate over whether the Federal Communications Commission should treat broadband service like utility, or more precisely as a Title II common carrier service, in order to impose net neutrality rules. Ultimately, the FCC did reclassify broadband to enforce net neutrality in 2015, but never imposed strict utility regulations like price caps or network unbundling. Now, broadband users enthusiastically supported the rules, and ISPs admitted to investors later that the extra regulations didn't harm their business at all. But the FCC deregulated the broadband industry anyways, eliminating net neutrality rules and other consumer protections such as a prohibition on hidden fees. Now, since that decision, the top ISPs have decreased network investment despite operating in the most regulated free environment they sought. And the FCC has relied on ISPs voluntarily promising instead of real rules to keep customers online during this crucial time. I see some things going on here, guys. I want to throw this to Curtis first. Do we have a bad case deja vu? Didn't the federal government break up Ma Bell back in the day to introduce competition into the telecom industry? Relatively recent history. Isn't that relatively recent history here?
Well, it is relatively recent history for some of us. For others, it is back in the prehistory days. But you're right. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, Ma Bell was broken up into the RBOX, or Regional Bell Operating Companies. And later, things were changed to allow people to do things like own their own telephones. And the stage was set for alternative long-distance carriers like MCI and Sprint to spring up and offer those services. It was said that we would have much cheaper phone service and much better phone service. And the fact is, we have had both of those. I mean, I can remember as a child, if someone called in long distance, all activity stopped because that was a very expensive transaction. Long distance calls were enormously expensive. Today, long distance calls for most of us are some variation on free. And even if we call internationally, it's very, very cheap. The thing is, it took us the better part of 40 years to get there. I think we're seeing some of that now. We're seeing the ISPs who got what they want, and instead of immediately doing what they told regulators and legislators they would do, turn around and put the additional funds into enhancing their infrastructure, they return them to their shareholders as profits. They're going to do that as long as possible. And the thing is, we will ultimately get higher speed, lower cost bandwidth. It's just going to take us many years and put us in the United States at a competitive disadvantage to the rest of the world when it comes to broadband performance and quality.
Right, right. Now, Cheaper, you remember back in the day the insane hassle of selling modems during the regulated telecom era, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was inside sales for Universal Data Systems, Codex, and Motorola, and so forth. And back in the days of regulation, it was a real, real pain in the butt to sell modems. And the interesting thing is dial-up modems were pathetically slow, and the innovation was glacial. Now, the interesting thing is once deregulation happened, all of a sudden the amount of innovation in the world of modems skyrocketed. So anyway, one of the things I wanted to point out is I actually had a round of golf with the president of Hawaiian Telephone. Originally, I was on a board to try and break the monopoly for Hawaiian Telephone in Honolulu. And it worked out pretty nicely. We got it. We actually broke the monopoly a year before the feds did. I was actually persona non grata with Hawaiian Telephone. I was barred from the building for several years. Many, many, many years later, probably almost a decade, playing that round of golf, the president basically told me, you know, as much as we hated getting hated the monopoly getting broken, we're actually making way more money now than we ever did during the monopoly. And that, I think, is the lesson we need to keep in mind. We don't want regulation, because regulation means lack of imagination for a lot of things. Or it's so hard to get permission to do something that people just give up. Now, this whole deregulation has been great. We've had a lot of innovation and so forth, but we also have people answering to stockholders and trying to pad their profit margins to the point where they can get that big IPO or this or that or whatever's. We aren't planning. I think it's going, like Kurt said, it's going to take some time for that pendulum to swing, and hopefully these carriers are going to start actually investing new services and things like that. I think as consumers, one of the things we need to do is we need to make our voices heard. If your ISP, if you think your internet service is not very good, complain, and complain in writing. If you are hearing about different things, complain to your legislative body, both your state legislative body and your Congress critters. Because if you do not make your voice heard, the people that actually have the ability to put pressure on these ISPs aren't going to lift a finger. So vote with your dollars and open your mouth and say something.
Going back to the two, I think it's interesting. The industry is afraid of being made, internet being made a utility. In fact, ISPs have pushed back quite a bit. Curtis, I want to throw this to you, last word before we jump to your bite. What are ISPs afraid of here? Doesn't Title II offer a bunch of perks for them to build out their networks and expand?
Well, it can. It really depends on precisely how they think the business is going to go in the future. And let's remember something that's happened. If all they want to be is pipes, then Title II does offer a great deal. But think about the number of companies out there who started out being a transport mechanism, but who have ultimately gotten into the content business. I think many companies recognize that simple infrastructure is almost inevitably a race to the bottom. It becomes a pure dollars and cents play for your customers. The value add is what they're all looking for. What can we add to this that others can't? And they're worried that in being defined as a utility, they will be limited in what they can add on top of the basic pipes. They look at companies like electric utilities, which are the definition of a utility company. And in most places, they can provide electricity, but they've had difficulty in various places going much beyond that because of their heavily regulated nature. Depends on what the company thinks the future of their industry is going to look like. And I think in much of these battles, if we look hard, we can see that many of these organizations think that being a simple pipe is not the way they're going to earn most of their money in the future.
Thanks, Curtis. We'll see what happens. Let's go ahead and jump into the next bite, because this one is actually very interesting to me personally, because I have a lot of apps on my iDevice that are actually no longer in the store. I use them all the time because they're useful to me. I'm not going to name names, but there's some really good ones there. I always wonder what happens when these things kind of almost get abandoned. Obviously, does it make my device more insecure? Curtis?
Well, interestingly enough, the answer to that question could be a resounding yes. I mean, all of us who have been owners of computing devices, whether laptop, desktop, handheld phones, tablets, whatever, if you've done that for any length of time, you know that applications, apps, come and go. The app that was so hot this week can be something that the developers have abandoned next week. Software libraries, the things that make up those applications, are in the same boat. The people who maintain them come and go, sometimes because their lives end, sometimes because the organization that was employing them and paying them to maintain the library has changed their job, and sometimes just because life intrudes and they get bored and walk away. The software libraries that are no longer being actively developed are a huge problem for programmers and a source of vulnerabilities, and abandoned code bases can also be a huge issue for users. In a report recently published, mobile security firm Wandera argued that many mobile users have applications installed on their smartphones and tablets that are no longer in application development nor offered on the major app stores. The company discovered a significant number of such applications on employees' devices during its regular scanning for security threats. The applications pose security risks, they say, because any vulnerability found in the code will never be patched. The abandoned applications can be on worker devices. They're outdated, not maintained, and those worker devices become enterprise security problems. Now, productivity applications are the most common as measured by the number of devices that still have an abandoned app installed, according to the report. The original Samsung keyboard software, which came installed by default on some of the manufacturer's devices, is the top application found on smartphones with 40 times more installs than the next most common, which is the flashlight app. Moreover, the Samsung keyboard application has a known vulnerability, and the Samsung keyboard app is no longer being developed or supported. Now, Apple has taken steps to keep code current on the Mac platform, and it tends to warn well in advance when applications that are not going to be compatible with the new versions of an operating system. That is true as well on iOS. The problem is that even though Apple runs a fairly aggressive campaign, they don't want users to feel that something has been removed from their devices. And that leads some security experts to think that Apple and the major Android platform suppliers should be more active in removing those abandoned apps. Now, Apple does allow users to set the device to offload unused apps in the settings, which can help reduce the danger of abandoned applications. But for now, users should occasionally check their mobile devices for old apps they no longer use and remove them. I know many people who have page after page after page on their home screen filled with apps. I've seen statistics that the average user has well over 100 apps on their smartphone. And you have to ask, if you're somewhere close to that average, how many of those apps do you actively use? So, Lou, I want to go to you first. This is all about mobile apps, but don't you see in your industry desktop and even server apps that fall into the same category that over time they're simply abandoned?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of developer and companies out there that do have actually abandoned applications. It's unfortunate that they don't take their customers seriously enough to warn them of decommissioning or sunsetting of application support. Some of them do the right thing. They usually try to inform you, give you enough time to find another solution. Some of them just go bankrupt and belly up, and you never know, depending on the application. So I think it's basically true to the fact that more things you install on your machine, especially in a desktop, the more chance you lose sight of all those different applications and services that are running and be unaware that things might be vulnerable. And so that's why keeping machines clean is very important, especially desktops. You know, registries are still there and applications still stay dormant for a long time. I know I've installed applications a long time ago. Like a lot of my Adobe applications, they install these secret services. Now, granted, Adobe's going to be around for a while, but it doesn't mean that I don't know if a service that's got installed there is now deprecated. They no longer support it and they no longer update it. And it's just sitting there dormant, potentially a security issue. So I tend to wipe my workstations every, you know, so often just to clean out all that extra garbage that's out there. And I'm sure organizations do the same. They reimage machines and push out new updates. But there is a lot of that, and it's unfortunate. And again, even if they do the right thing and let their customers know that they're decommissioning or sunsetting the application or service, sometimes people don't get it. Some people don't know. Or again, these companies just tend to disappear.
Well, Brian, let me ask you, with all this going on, you know, Lou mentioned regularly re-imaging systems. Is that the best answer? That seems like a way to spend a weekend on your device. Is re-imaging the only way to go, or are there other practices people can use to try and minimize these old abandoned apps on their systems?
You know, I just don't have a good answer. You know, the reality is I also do the same thing. I don't migrate machines. I reinstall and all I move is data because there's so much trash left over that all I'm doing is I'm moving load. I'm moving stuff that I don't use. So why bother? Because there's an awful lot of stuff, you know, libraries, utilities, special services that are installed because, you know, I'm sorry, you know, programmers are inherently lazy. They don't want to rewrite if something already exists. So they'll kind of piggyback on, you know, a standard utility. So those hooks, those registry entries, those, you know, whatevers are going to be there. So that's what I do. That's also what we did in the military. We did not migrate because there's too much chance of something being left over. Now, I am going to draw an analogy, though. This doesn't just happen in our industry. This happens in all kinds of places. Like I was trying to fix my electric range. I couldn't even buy parts for it anymore, even though it was a very common, very popular electric range. From General Electric, I couldn't buy parts. I had to search far and wide and find it. You know, it's great. And, you know, it's just the way things go. You know, we go after the shiny. And the same thing happens in the development world. But, you know, yeah, it happens. I've still got production COBOL code. I'm not sure I really want to admit it, but it still exists. I definitely have production Fortran code. It got migrated over from an IBM 370 over to a supercomputer, but it's still the same basic code. So I think it's something we're going to have to live with. It happens all the time. I totally agree with Lou. You need to spend a little bit of time and go through, and do you really need that, you know, last version of Candy Crush, or can you get rid of it? You know, clean up once in a while. You know, spring cleaning. Yeah. When you do spring cleaning for your house, do spring cleaning for your mobile devices. How's that sound?
Well, spring cleaning sounds like the kind of adventure that we all need these days. And we're going to have the opportunity to do it in real life and on our devices. Well, it's time to do some cleaning around here, get rid of this bite, and head on over to the rest of the show. Lou, we'll hand it back to you.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, next up, my favorite part of the show, we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight. But before we do, we actually have to thank another great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Barracuda. Now, Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Think about it. Suddenly you have dozens, hundreds, or maybe even thousands of employees working remotely, each one of them getting tons of emails every day, making them vulnerable. Now, 91% of all cyber attacks start in the email. Spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. Multiply that by how many employees times how many emails. One click on the wrong email can cost you money, customers, and even your reputation. Now, Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they've observed a recent spike of 667% in this type of attack since the end of February. Now, get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. Now, it includes a lot of stuff here. All-in-one email security, backup, and or archiving, AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise, and automated incident response that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address those attacks. Security awareness training is also available to educate your workforce so your employees can be first in line on defense against those attacks. Now, we've covered this a couple times on TWiET, and in the current climate, bad guys are targeting people using social engineering techniques. They actually impersonate organizations like the UN World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to trick users into opening malicious emails. Users access the malicious code cited, and that's it. Their devices are now attackers' machines. It's time to take back control of your security. Ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. Now, to uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/enterprise. That's barracuda.com/enterprise. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the TWiET Riot. And today we have Joe Garber. He's Global Head Strategy and Solutions for Micro Focus. Joe, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Now, our audience loves to hear people's journey through tech. Can you maybe take us through a journey and how you found yourself at Micro Focus?
I'd be happy to. Yeah, so I joined Micro Focus a couple of years ago. My background goes back to Silicon Graphics, IBM, more recently HP, and I joined HP as after it acquired Autonomy. I had been with Autonomy for a while. HP, as you may know, acquired Autonomy. It was involved with that organization. And then HP, as you may know, spun off its enterprise software and some other assets to Hewlett Packard Enterprise, and joined Hewlett Packard Enterprise. And then most recently, Hewlett Packard Enterprise spun off its enterprise software assets again to Micro Focus in 2017. So I've been with Micro Focus for the last couple of years, and in the role that you described, going out talking to customers and partners about market trends and the intersection of technology and process and how they digitally transform their organizations and what they can do to take advantage of that.
Right. Now, we've talked a lot about here on TWiET about digital transformation. Obviously, a lot of organizations are trying to find that almost turnkey solution to help them out here. Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about your role at Micro Focus and what are the top of minds for customers when it comes to digital transformation?
Yeah. Well, as I said, my role is largely going out and talking to customers. I spent a lot of time on the road, not recently, of course, but over the last several years, and talking about what organizations are trying to accomplish. And I think what I hear often is, look, there are a number of forces that are coming to bear right now that are forcing our hand in terms of what our IT strategy is. And that's, some obvious things like vulnerabilities, emerging vulnerabilities, as you just talked about, evolving customer needs, IoT, mobility, the advent or the gaining traction of the cloud, obviously, over the last several years as well. And then, you know, new regulations as well. One of the things I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of years talking about is the requirements of, say, privacy regulations from GDPR. And of course, there we're tracking 25, 27 different regulations around the world right now that are, you know, yet again, putting additional pressure on organizations to be able to manage their data, their applications, their identities in new and different and challenging ways. And so, you know, ultimately what organizations are doing is they're looking at things from kind of two perspectives. We talk about it, the yin and the yang. It's driving the top line and managing the bottom line. And they're looking to leverage technology to provide, you know, differentiated and compelling experiences or outcomes to be able to take advantage of the opportunities in front of them, but also to manage some of the challenges that are being placed in front of them as well.
There's always a lot of analysis, a lot of investigations, research going on. I'm always curious to hear about some of these that have to deal with digital transformation. Now, you recently did some research with IDC on digital transformation. What did you guys get out of that? What was the analysis?
Well, you know, I think the big takeaway was, look, digital transformation is growing in terms of spending. It's at about a third of all IT spending today, and the expectation is that that'll go up to about 50% of all IT investment going forward. So the reality is, as we all might expect, the expectations of IT to evolve and to digitally transform are increasing. And that research, by the way, was done before, or at least largely done before, a lot of the changes that we've seen happen in terms of how we work and where we work. That what we're seeing is pushing that envelope even further along the way. So, you know, the spending in IT, specifically around digital transformation, is one big takeaway that we had. Some others that we saw were, not surprisingly, those organizations that had prioritized digital transformation had increased their revenue. They have the ability to identify new business models and new ways to engage with their customers, and underfunded parts of the business. All different areas where they're driving revenue, and as I said, growing the top line. Not surprisingly as well, those organizations that have prioritized digital transformation have found better ways to engage with their customers as well. So those are a couple of things. Of course, many are using digital transformation to drive down costs, as I said, as well. So I think those are some of the big takeaways that we had from IDC. I think the other big one was, As we looked really hard at the market and what organizations were trying to accomplish with digital transformation, yes, there's lots of different elements to it. But fundamentally, what organizations are trying to do are really four simple things. That's simply stated, not simple in terms of accomplishing them. That's to move faster. It's to have greater agility. It's to secure what matters most to the organization. I mentioned that a second ago, applications, data, and identities. And then to leverage insights to drive value for the organization. So those are some of the big takeaways we had with IDC.
And now, kind of going on those, obviously there's a lot of technology out there trying to assist in this, because people are trying to do, you know, hybrid data movement, compliance, all of these things. What is Micro Focus doing to help here?
Well, that's a good question. The short answer is a lot. We're a company, one of the 10 largest enterprise software companies in the world. We have 300 product lines. So we have the luxury of delivering, you know, really a holistic set of solutions for organizations. And the way we've organized our solutions and the way we prioritize the investments within them, you know, whether that's R&D or M&A or go-to-market, has really been around the four elements I talked about. So driving speed, which is really akin to enterprise DevOps, delivering a greater agility, which is really around hybrid IT management. It's providing security and again, through security risk and governance, you know, compliance obviously fits into there as well. And then providing insights with our predictive analytics solutions. And the reality is, you know, organizations don't come to us typically, and at least right away, and say, I need all of those things right away. Often what we see is organizations come to us with a specific problem. They've been through some of the challenges of the past of, look, I put a platform in and I tried to do boil the ocean approach to it, and we didn't get the value out of it that we needed to. So often with that experience in the back of their mind, often what we hear from them is, look, you know, help us start with one problem. You know, whether it's one challenge within, say, security, risk, and governance, or within one department or one geography, solve that problem, build out the ROI on that, and then over time we'll continue to build within that particular area or across the different elements to ultimately digitally transform as an organization.
Right. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in. Let's start with you first, Curtis. Curtis?
You know, you're talking about digital transformation in IDC. I spent a lot of years working at IDG, which is IDC's corporate sibling. So I know the IDC language and many of their analysts. But I've also been going to Gartner, the Gartner Symposium, for years. And so I hear their language, and you hit the digitalization and all of these things. You get lots of different words around the concept of basically using IT to bring more value to the business. Are there profound differences in all of these terms that we're using, or are we really just fighting the battle over different analysis groups trying to put their own stamp on the same set of ideas?
Well, it depends, is the short answer. And I've been to lots of those symposiums as well, and there are certainly unique elements in each particular case. But fundamentally, you know, as I talked about, you know, what we see, whether we go to IDC or Gartner or Forrester or any of the other analyst firms, is that organizations are trying to accomplish those elements that I talked about. It's speed, agility, security, and insights. And I would say it's not just to drive value, though that's certainly a big part of it. But again, you know, you look at things like RPA and being able to deliver applications faster at lower risk and lower cost. There's obviously there's the yin and yang, or a cost element that people are taking into account as well.
Okay, so we're talking about this transformation that's going to be happening. This path that a company is going to want to walk along. There are obviously many facets to that. You know, we often talk about the triad of people, process, technology, all of that. So if you're going to look at this, let's say you're one of the handful of companies that has yet to start on this whole process. Do you look at the culture and the processes of the company, and then get the IT to support that? Do you start with bringing in new IT systems and change your culture to wrap around them, a la what was happening around SAP in the 90s? Or do the two things have to happen at the same time? How do you make this digital transformation if you're starting from scratch?
Well, I think that's an important place to start, is many organizations don't have to start from scratch. They can, you know, and so we talk often about the desire to, you know, often customers will come to us and say, look, you know, we want to rip and replace and start over from scratch. And that's a place to start. But of course, that the benefits of ripping and replacing and starting from scratch are that you get all new technology and all new processes and have the ability to hit the reset button. But what we found is that many organizations, most organizations, you know, certainly any of that have been around for any period of time, have developed over time, and they have core business systems. COBOL was mentioned earlier, and I'm very familiar with that. That's one of the technologies we support here and have for, you know, for almost 40 plus years of our existence, and of course the technology is even older than that. But there are these systems of record that organize, and by the way, IP and processes that have been built up around those core business systems that are delivering real value to you as an organization. So, you know, starting completely from scratch doesn't always make the most amount of sense. Often what we suggest to our customers is, you know, take a modernization approach. Identify what your core needs are, where the real value is coming. Obviously look downstream at what you want to accomplish over time, but you know, start with it and modernize, bridging, you know, the existing and the emerging, your technology so you can digitally transform. So we often talk about is running and transforming at the same time. And that's what we're seeing a lot more organizations wanting to do is that. So they not all of them are starting from scratch. That said, you're to answer your initial question, what matters most? Obviously, vision is one of the things that really matters. I just saw a fact recently, not from IDC, but from another organization, that today, 85% of digital transformations fail. And I think there's one fundamental reason for that, and that is because of the culture, because many organizations haven't adopted the risk-taking kind of mentality, the fail-fast kind of thought process, and haven't approached digital transformation the right way and in sort of a methodical, pragmatic process, as I just described. So I think that culture is really a core part of really culture and then a commitment over time, because digital transformation doesn't happen overnight. It's often an issue, a multiple set of initiatives that take place over time. So you need to have the buy-in from your top executives to be able to manage that over time.
All right. So I'd like to kind of follow up on that answer. You know, when we start talking about best practices and things like that, my personal opinion is one of the best practices is actually a psychological approach to how you do a transformation in any type of organization. Do you have some tips and tricks on best practices on how to deal with the old folks, the older folks, the people that have been there for a long time that are also the most mired in the mud on and don't want to transform?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is yes, we do. And it varies, of course, from organization to organization. But often one of the first and most important things to do is to bring them in and have them be part of the process, provide their input early on, because not only does that get sort of an implied buy-in from them, but oftentimes you find out from the old guard, if you will, that some of the skeletons in the closet, things that will break if you evolve them too fast and too much. Or alternatively, where things are really providing value to you as an organization that you simply don't want to break. So I think that's one of the big parts there is you know, can bring them in early. The second one that we've seen often is you know, and it seems sort of self-evident, but I've seen it not work, you know, with some frequency, and that is to share the vision. What is it you're trying to accomplish? Not just 1 year out, but 5 years out, 10 years out, and then ladder up what they're doing to that vision over a period of time, because people need to understand what they're trying to accomplish, what the organization's trying to accomplish, to be able to evolve over time. And then, of course, you know, a significant amount of it is communicating early and often. Making sure that you're touching base with people, explaining where things have changed, because invariably, probably not all of it, but a significant amount of the strategy you put in place in year one might evolve in years two and three, and that might create additional confusion, which to some people might mean that things have broken down, and they throw their hands up and say, "Wow, this isn't working," when in fact, it's just the playing field is evolving a little bit. So I think the three of those things really are very important when you're managing any kind of change. Digital transformation, of course, being one of those.
All right. Now, a lot of organizations, they tend to either want to get all disparate systems, all systems up into the cloud, get that all transformed right away. Some of them want to take more incremental approach. Now, Curtis, you know, a lot of organizations, they try to be agile. And they try to fail fast, like that we've been talking about. But is that the best model for everybody? Is there more of a gradual model for some organizations?
Well, I think that you still have a lot of organizations that do decide that they're going to stay with their traditional development methods. And I think that's something that I would love to hear from Joe is the move to digital transformation something that must be accomplished within an agile framework, or are there other organizational methods that can be used and be equally successful?
Well, you know, again, it depends. Answer: it depends on the organization, depends what the objectives are, and so forth. We're seeing a significant move towards DevOps, and so that's a big part of you know where we're putting our investments today. So yes, I would say more often than not, you're seeing that move to Agile, move to DevOps is being a significant part. Is that a requirement in every single case? No, of course it's not. Just like you know is moving to the cloud. You know, we have customers that'll come to us from time to time and say, got to move to the cloud. And often they don't mean I need to move everything to the cloud, though it's stated that way from time to time. And what they really mean is they need to come up with a strategy whereby they can get some additional agility by moving some information to the cloud. And there are other elements that need to come into play there as well. And that's being exacerbated by some of the changes we're seeing today with the pandemic and such, whereby there are new vulnerabilities that are being picked up today as people are moving things to the cloud. So there are considerations that need to take place even as they're making some of these adjustments.
Joe, I've got a follow up, and this kind of goes around. We've had lots and lots of guests talking about AI and machine learning, and how big an impact is this? A flash in the pan, or is this really going to be a big paradigm shift in the way we do business?
Well, my personal belief is that it is of significant importance and to virtually any organization, regardless of whether you're trying to drive the top line or again manage the bottom line. You see AI and machine learning being applied to boosting and sustaining revenue with data mining. Obviously, that's the obvious example, or driving customer engagement with chatbots, or delivering a greater speed, as we talked about, with things like smarter functional testing or cognitive search. And then, you know, again, you have the bottom line, improving quality and delivery with things like AI ops and streamlining and enhancing processes like with RPA. And then even being applied to things like detecting risk. With user behavior analytics as an example of that, or applying it to physical security. We have a customer in Asia Pacific that it's a big city that leverages artificial intelligence to triangulate a number of different things as an example. So, you know, what's happening with CCTV and what's happening on social media and what they're seeing you know, elsewhere in terms of facial recognition, and they're pulling all of those things together to help manage risk. So you're seeing AI and machine learning come into many different elements of digital transformation, and I think it's here to stay. And I'll tell you, I cut my teeth in e-discovery many years ago. So that's effectively search for legal purposes, and you know, that's an area where there was initial resistance to AI and machine learning. It was called technology assisted review or predictive analytics at the time, at least within that environment. And there were so many concerns and questions about what if I get this wrong? What is the efficacy rate of leveraging, you know, AI and machine learning? But over time, obviously that technology has gotten better. People have understood the technology more. And now, of course, we're seeing it, you know, being applied to many different types of technologies that aren't in the traditional sort of big data sense, if you will. I can tell you that we at Micro Focus have some really strong technology and Vertica and IDOL, and we're going out of our way to make sure that we're integrating those technologies into our DevOps, our hybrid IT, our security risk and governance solutions, because we see that as being a wave of the future.
Joe, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. I did want to give you a chance maybe to tell the folks at home where organizations to go to learn more about digital transformation and more about what Micro Focus has to offer.
Yeah, happy to. Well, you know, I think starting off with, you know, where do you go to learn more information about digital transformation? I think you go and you talk to your peers. There are plenty of great LinkedIn sites. There are a number of different places like this where you can learn more about it, of course. There are many industry analysts we've talked about that have provided some great information around digital transformation with many of the different analyst firms we've already mentioned. I would mention you're picturing here. We just launched a microsite around digital transformation that you can reach at microfocus.com/DX, DX for course for digital transformation, where you can see a lot of the information we've talked about from IDC, from other thought leaders and some from of our product experts to learn more about what digital transformation is and how it can be useful to you as an organization.
Great. Thank you again. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Thing Enterprise podcast in the universe. So keep up with your IT news by listening to us while you wait for your Uber Eats. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, of course, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on with you in this coming week, and where can people find you and get in touch with you?
I am packing and packing and packing. And actually, I'm also doing inventory because when you move across the country, I'm going to be moving across the ocean and across the country. I think I ought to insure my stuff. And I'm cringing to see how much the underwriter is going to charge me. Woohoo. But I would love to hear from the Twilight Riot. I am ADVNETLAB on Twitter, so Advanced Net Lab. I'm also Chibert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. At twit.tv. But better yet, why don't you hit twiet at twit.tv and that will hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your show ideas. I actually really don't mind if you hate what we did. You know, we've had some fans say we really hated this segment, and we had a very nice discussion. It was very professional. Don't mind it. Criticism is actually a really good way of making sure everything improves. So we'd like to hear from you. Also, Lou's going to tell it again, but the Twit community is another great place for a open forum. So we'd love to hear from you folks. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Thank you, Chibert. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week? Where can people find you and your work?
Well, as always, people can find my writing over at Dark Reading and at the edge of Dark Reading. Just had a piece up on a rogues gallery of macOS malware, and also been doing some 101s explaining things like what is SQL injection, what is cross-site scripting, and I've got more of those come. I'm also working on a piece on what a new normal might look like for cybersecurity if we got to choose what that new normal was going to look like. If you've got some ideas on that, feel free to hit me up on my Twitter feed down there at KG4GWA. Let me know what you think. I think it might be fascinating to know what cybersecurity would look like if we didn't have all of the legacy stuff to deal with, if we could design it ourselves.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to get your enterprise goodness and watch and listen to our show. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen. So go right now to catch up on your enterprise news by going to our show page, twit.tv/twiet. There you'll find all of the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, guest information, even the links of the stories that we do in the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting the audio version, the video version, the HD video version of your choice. And listen on any one of your devices because we're on every one of those podcast applications and on YouTube as well. So check that out. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise news. So go ahead and subscribe. But after you subscribe, impress your friends, your family, your coworkers, share the gift of Twiet because they'll definitely be impressed and they'll get their enterprise and IT news for that week. And if you're already subscribed and you're available during the day, like right now around 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Friday, we do the show live.twit.tv each and every week. Come see how the show is run. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see behind the scenes. We love doing the show and we have a lot of fun and a lot of banter. So come check that out. But if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. We have a great chat room here, irc.twit.tv. They have a great set of characters. We have some great content that comes out of there. So definitely come and jump into that as well if you're going to watch the show live. But like Chibert said, you can't be part of the show live. You subscribe, you're listening, but you also want to be part of the conversation. We have a great community. It's a great website out there, twit.community. It's a great website. Come join 24/7 discussion. All the communities out there. We have co-hosts out there. We have the show. Sometimes the guests jump out there. We have a lot of technology discussions, a lot of discussions. Some people actually ask questions on how to get started. We actually help them and work through some solutions for them. So definitely check that out, twit.community. It's a great place to be. It's a great place to be part of the discussion 24/7. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all of my enterprise tidbits. Plus, I get to have great conversations with people like you, of course. And also, I post what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. If you want to learn more about that, you can always go to developer.microsoft.com/office. We have some really great ways to customize your office solutions to make it more productive for you as well. I want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week. They support us doing this weekend Enterprise Tech, and we couldn't do it without them. So thank you for all their support. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit. And of course, we have to thank Mr. Brian G one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the show bookings, he does all the show notes, he talks to the PR people, he gets all the guests on. We just really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Chibert, for all your work, especially during your move time. We appreciate that. Thank you, sir. And before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. Jeff, are you? How's things going over there, Twitter? Are you still the lone man in the studio?
I'm still the lone man here. We're starting to bring a couple people back, keeping them at great distances. So our controller is here doing some work today. And Anthony will be here later for the Twit After Hours show. So that's going to be real awesome. And that was a good show today, guys. So really appreciate it.
Yeah, we have a great show, and we always have great guests. So, well, thank you for support. We appreciate it, Jeff.
You're very welcome.
Take care, and until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by Ron Richards, Florence Ion, and a rotating crew of Android journalists, developers, and enthusiasts, where we talk about the latest news, hardware, and apps for the Android faithful. You can subscribe by going to twit.tv/AAA or find the show in your podcatcher of choice. That's All About Android.